From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Life or death for the Boston Marathon bomber. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The evidence of guilt is not open to question. Johar Tsarnaev's attorneys conceded he helped plant the bombs that killed three and injured 260. Now the jury that convicted him must decide the sentence. But even the families of victims disagree. Some insist only his death will provide closure. Others say his execution would inevitably be delayed by an endless round of appeals, prolonging their agony. Opening arguments began today in the penalty phase of a trial that raises basic questions about justice in America. Today's talking point, how much of your money should you give away? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. The state of Massachusetts has abolished capital punishment, but the Boston Marathon bomber was convicted in federal court. Nobody doubts Johar Tsarnaev was guilty, and the penalty phase makes execution an option, even though Bostonians are opposed. We'll hear about a process that began today. Today's talking point, philosopher Peter Singer, was made famous by his book, Animal Liberation. Now he's focused on ethical living in a different way. We'll hear why he encouraged one of his best students to work on Wall Street and get as rich as he could. First, this news update. Senate leaders have reached a deal on human trafficking, a bill held up because of a dispute over abortion. The agreement will allow a confirmation vote on Loretta Lynch, the nominee for Attorney General. Bob Cusack is editor-in-chief of The Hill. That's a news service that covers the U.S. Capitol. Hi, Bob. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
So, what does abortion have to do with human trafficking, have to do with the nominee for Attorney General?
Well, that's what a lot of Democrats have been asking. It basically revolves around something called the Hyde Amendment, and this is an amendment added to appropriations bills, usually, that bars the funding of certain funding for abortion services, and this has been in the context of this anti-human trafficking legislation, where Mitch McConnell said, listen, unless we get a deal on this, I'm not going to move to Loretta Lynch. So Lynch's nomination has been hanging out there for nearly 6 months, and this has not sat well with Democrats and the White House. And finally, they got a deal. Both sides gave a little bit on the abortion language, coming up with funding from both Congress as well as sex offenders that would fund, that would help the victims of trafficking. So overall, both sides are claiming victory, and that's a sign that things are working in Washington for once.
The White House is saying today that it's hopeful that Loretta Lynch's nomination will, in fact, finally be considered. But here's how impatient President Obama was last Friday.
Call Loretta Lynch for a vote. Get her confirmed. Put her in place. Let her do her job. This is embarrassing. A process like this.
So the president, his latest verdict on how the Senate works. Explain how the Hyde Amendment would have been extended if the Republicans had their way.
Well, they were trying to, Democrats say that they were trying to expand it, and this is not an appropriations bill. So they said they balked at it. Most Democrats, some Democrats did vote for the measure to move forward. So on this issue, the deal was is that, okay, we're going to use a funding source from a bill that just passed. It's a bit complicated on a Medicare bill. And then we're going to use a separate fund from sex criminals to help these trafficking victims. Overall, this is something that Mitch McConnell really needed because he is trying to make the case that the Senate is working again. And President Obama has taken this very personally, as you heard from that soundbite. In that press conference, he was actually earlier extolling Congress for getting deals on Medicare and an Iran deal, and there are other bipartisan bills on education that are moving through. But then he went back to the mics to say that the Lynch handling of the Lynch nomination has been embarrassing. And that, I think, applied some pressure on congressional Republicans, and that's why they went forward with this deal.
A little more on why Mitch McConnell needs to get the Senate working again. Why do you say that?
Oh, well, he needs to get it done because basically they have a slim majority, and the Senate map in 2016 is very friendly for Democrats. A lot of Republicans in states that President Obama won twice. That's going to be a tough test. If you look at Mark Kirk from Illinois, Republican, he's going to face a challenging reelection. We also have Rob Portman in Ohio, who is going to certainly being targeted by Democrats, and he's raising a lot of money because this majority that Mitch McConnell has is fragile. So he's going to have to make the case that this Congress, as opposed to the last one, which Harry Reid control was the majority leader in the Senate, is better. We've gotten some things done, maybe not huge things like immigration reform or tax reform, and neither of those are going to move. But we've gotten these bills on Medicare and education and maybe on the Patriot Act through the Congress. So please reelect us. The Senate Republican majority gets things done. That's what Mitch McConnell wants to say in the fall of 2016.
So what's the nature of this human trafficking bill that finally was passed today, or that will be passed? Excuse me. The White House is only hopeful that this process will get underway. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this is a measure that actually had been very bipartisan in the past and had been passed by both chambers and committees in the last Congress. But then it led to some finger-pointing because Republicans said, well, Democrats didn't read the bill. Democrats said, wait a minute, you changed the language on abortion. We can't vote for this. So there was a lot of finger-pointing. It went on for a while. In mid-March, Mitch McConnell went on the Sunday shows, and he said, I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to call for Lynch to come to the floor unless we get this human trafficking bill. And we've been hearing some Republicans wanting to use this as a political issue because it divided the Democrats. Some Democrats did vote with the Republicans to move forward with it. And now it's finally getting done.
All right, Bob Cusack, always good to have you on our program, Editor-in-Chief of The Hill. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, life or death for the Boston Marathon bomber on To The Point.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The penalty phase of the Boston Marathon bomber trial began today with a prosecutor showing jurors a picture of Johar Tsarnaev giving the middle finger to a video surveillance camera in his jail cell 3 months after he'd been arraigned. U.S. Attorney Nadine Pellegrini called him unconcerned, unrepentant, and unchanged. Masha Gessen covered the guilt phase of the trial. She is author of The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Masha Gessen, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now we will hear, of course, from the various families, victims' families, and others about what this means to them.
Right. So it's an odd trial, right? First, we heard the prosecution mount one case to prove Johar Tsarnaev's guilt, although the defense never really contested the fact that he was one of the marathon bombing. Now they have to go through the story for a second time in order for the jury to decide whether he's getting life imprisonment without parole or death. And the prosecution is once again mounting a similarly painful case, telling the stories of the many people who lost loved ones in the marathon bombing or lost limbs in the marathon bombing or otherwise injured. So that began this morning right after opening arguments in the second phase.
Tell us about the Richards family who lost the youngest of all the victims involved.
The Richards family was absolutely devastated by the bombing. They lost their 8-year-old son, Martin. Their 6-year-old daughter lost a leg. The mother, the Mrs. Richard, lost sight in one of her eyes. They have both of the adults in the family have suffered hearing loss. This is a family that's been absolutely devastated. Mr. Richard testified in the guilt phase of the trial, describing watching his son die, describing saving his daughter, who had had her leg severed, describing what he lived through while his family members were going through surgeries in the days after the bombing. And late last week, the Richards published an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe calling for an end to the trial, calling for the government to offer Tsarnaev life without the possibility of parole or appeal in exchange for ending this conversation that's been so devastating for them and for everybody who's been in the courtroom and for everybody who's been following the coverage.
Obviously, that had an enormous impact because of the devastation of their loss. Here they are, of all people, saying, let's allow this man to continue to live. Their point being, as I understand it, that if he gets the death sentence, then it will be followed by probably years of appeal, and they won't have closure.
This is right, and their call has now been joined by other victims, including a couple where both the husband and the wife lost limbs, lost legs, in the bombing, who are basically saying the same thing: we want to stop talking about this. And I think that this points to a very difficult conundrum: the needs of the victims, and I think the needs of the city of Boston in this case are different from the needs of national security. Boston really has been devastated not just by the bombing, but by the trial. But we still need, there's still many things that we don't know about what happened before the bombing and after the bombing. And these are things that we need to know in order to prevent similar tragedies in the future. And perhaps this is an argument not for ending the trial, but for the fact that this trial should have been moved from Boston in the first place, as the defense asked for repeatedly.
One of the things we don't know that you've pointed out extensively is why the FBI didn't nail the older brother sooner and prevent this from happening.
Right. Well, so what we know is that the FBI interviewed Tamerlan Tsarnaev at least three times, the older brother, in 2011 after Russian secret services alerted them to his existence and pointed to him as a potential terrorism risk. Now, we don't exactly know what happened in those conversations, and we don't know whether the FBI or Tamerlan Tsarnaev ever thought that they had some sort of understanding and that perhaps he was working as an informant, as the FBI tried to get him to do. But what we do know is that less than 2 years after he had been fingered as a possible terrorism risk, he managed to buy enough supplies to build six bombs, build the bombs, and set two of them off at the Boston Marathon without the FBI noticing. And what we also know is that the FBI failed to identify him from photographs that were picked out from the surveillance tapes less than 24 hours after the bombing. And for 3 days after that, the FBI, which had gone out and interviewed him, could not identify him. So something has gone seriously wrong with the very process. This is the sort of thing that that we really need to look at. How come somebody who had been fingered as a terrorism risk was able to carry out a terrorist attack?
Is that information that would have come out if the trial had been held somewhere other than Boston? Is it something that it would come out during a extensive appeal if he were in fact sentenced to death?
Well, we can hope that this some information may come out during appeals. But if that happens, it's more likely to happen simply because this case remains the subject of public conversation and not because the trial itself would ferret this kind of information out. I mean, the American justice system is not designed to find the truth. That's not a flaw of the American justice system. That's just how it's structured. It is designed to assign guilt and apportion punishment. It is the FBI that's supposed to investigate these kinds of crimes, and it is civilian oversight. It is Congress that's supposed to hold the FBI accountable. And this is the part of the system that has failed. The FBI has failed to either prevent this attack or investigate it in ways that would be convincing. And the Congress has held to, has failed to call, to hold the FBI accountable.
All right, Marcia Gessen, I know you need to leave us. You're the author of The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy, an extensive account of the Tsarnaev family and the two people, one now deceased, of course, the other facing life imprisonment or death. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea Lyon is dean and professor at the Valparaiso School of Law. She's author of The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Interested in your take on the fact that apparently, as just alluded to by Marcia Gessen, the people of Boston, where in the state of Massachusetts there is no longer any death penalty, don't want to see the death penalty imposed. How important is that?
Well, that's a question of federalism, actually. You know, there are states that have voted out the death penalty or don't have it as a matter of their constitution, but we have a federal death penalty everywhere, and that's why the they're able to ask for the death penalty in Boston. And as I understand it, approximately 60% of the folks that live in Boston feel that life without parole is sufficient punishment and don't really want the death penalty. And that should be something that the Department of Justice takes into consideration when they're making their decision as to whether to seek the death penalty or not. I of course, have no way of knowing to what degree they paid attention to that.
You're opposed to the death penalty.
I am.
Why?
I'm opposed to it on a number of grounds. Some of them are personal. Most of them are pretty pragmatic, having to do with the fact that there's no showing that the death penalty has any deterrent effect at all. It is a huge gobbler of resources. It costs three or four times as much to try someone and put them to death as it would to try them and send them to life, just because of the extensive amount of work that goes into the jury selection, the large numbers of experts, all the larger number of lawyers on both sides, et cetera. Most of the cost is at the trial level, actually, more than the appeals. I oppose it because we get things wrong an awful lot. Not that there's a guilt innocence question in this case, but we keep getting the wrong guy, and we've executed a couple of people at least who weren't the right person at all. So there's a lot of reasons not to have it and not very many to have it when we have an alternative that, in fact, makes sure that the public is protected, which is life in prison.
Okay. As you point out, the issue of deterrence and whether we get the wrong guy, neither of those are questions here. You're a longtime friend of the defense attorney, Judy Clark. What do you think she's going to be able to say on behalf of Mr. Tsarnaev?
Well, you know, some of the theme is already obvious that he is not the leader, that his elder brother was the leader, and that he has bears responsibility, but perhaps somewhat less responsibility. A way to think about this is that the penalty phase is really making a decision not on whether or not Tsarnaev should be punished, because once there's a guilty verdict, the decision to punish is over. He's going to be punished. It's a question of which punishment. And the mitigating factors that the jury is looking at are to decide the relative moral culpability of the young man. Is he so utterly without redeeming value that we need to remove him from the earth, or will imprisonment for the rest of his life suffice as a punishment? So one of the themes clearly is that he was not the leader or the mastermind here. The rest of what Judy is going to present in terms of mitigation, I simply don't know. I mean, I haven't talked to her about this case because I knew I might likely be talking to the press, and I didn't want to be in a position where I knew things I could not reveal. And so I don't know what other kind of mitigating evidence she'll be presenting, but there's a lot of different kinds of things that get presented in mitigation regarding childhood, psychological problems, physical problems, intellectual functioning, all different kinds of things. And I presume that some of those are likely to be presented by her.
What about this picture that was shown to the jury apparently today of Tsarnaev giving the middle finger to the surveillance camera and the prosecutor making a good deal out of that?
Well, the prosecutor is making a big deal out of that because they really don't have anything else. And what I mean by that is generally speaking, in a penalty phase, what you're looking at is someone with a long criminal history. You know, I'm just saying in most death penalty cases, so you have a prior armed robbery or a prior, you know, sexual assault or something, and there's other kinds of evidence of crimes other than the one the jury has just convicted the defendant of to bring in as a reason to say this guy's had his chances and you should, you know, it's too late, he should die. They don't have that in this case. They have one horrific crime. I'm not in any way deprecating the seriousness of the crime, but they don't have other bad acts they can point to that he's done. So what they're trying to do is insinuate that he's heartless. You know, who knows why he gave the middle finger to the surveillance camera? Who knows what somebody might have been saying to him at that moment? Who knows? But that's hardly what would normally think of as aggravating evidence, which is usually prior bad acts or other fights, things like that.
Andrea Lyon again, a dean and professor at Valparaiso School of Law, author of The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive. Robert Blecker is criminal law professor at New York Law School. He's also author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst, which is a case for of the death penalty. Robert Blecker, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
How do you respond to what we have heard so far on the program in terms of whether it should be used to determine whether there be life or death in this case, particularly the objection to the death penalty by the people of Boston since they've been polled and the fact that the state of Massachusetts doesn't have the death penalty?
Well, there are two ways to look at that. One as the basis for prediction and the other as to the moral basis for going for it. As to prediction, obviously, if 60% of Bostonians are opposed to it and the jury represents them in some meaningful way, although it doesn't, and I can go into that in a minute, then the odds become longer that they will actually get it. But remember, this is a federal case, which means it's the United States of America, and therefore the relevant public, not as a matter of predicting what will happen, but as a matter of what should happen, the relevant public are the people of the United States. But in terms of reacting to some of the other things that were said, first of all, the middle finger, I think, is not because, as was just suggested, that they have nothing else, but it's to rebut a probable move by the defense to say, as the United States Supreme Court has said that they must be able to say, that one of the mitigating circumstances is his future ability to adjust to prison life and be a peaceful person there. That's probably going to counter it to some degree. Also, his potential remorse and regret. The point is that, yes, if he had a criminal record, that would be another an additional aggravating circumstance, but the crime itself provides so many of them. Recall, and they've been listed in advance as they have to be. It was an especially heinous, cruel, and depraved crime. It involved substantial planning and premeditation. There were multiple victims. The victims were particularly vulnerable. The United States was betrayed by somebody who had come in as a refugee and then gotten citizen status. The impact on the victims was enormous. He has shown a lack of remorse, and the very site that he selected is an iconic site that represents the essence of sport, and which makes this all the more horrifying. So the crime itself provides the aggravators. It's not hardly that they have nothing else.
Hold that thought. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation on our talking point later. How much of your money should you give away? The philosopher Peter Singer says, as much as you can. We'll hear about him back in a moment, or talk to him, I should say, back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Mormon Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the penalty phase of the trial of Johar Tsarnaev, the remaining Boston Marathon bomber, the brother of the man who died, of course, in the course of that a terrible event. We're talking right now with Robert Blecker, criminal law professor and author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. We've talked a bit about mitigating circumstances and circumstances that might lead to the ultimate penalty. What about the issue of punishment? And nobody disagrees that he's going to be punished. But how severe do you think the punishment should be?
Well, I hope they give him the death penalty. I'm convinced that he deserves it. And the problem is, and if you look at the Richard's statement, and of course it's horrifying how much they have suffered, and that's absolutely right. They said that the prosecution team has now ensured that justice will be served. But of course, justice is only served if the punishment fits the crime. And I've spent thousands of hours inside prisons in many states interviewing condemned and convicted killers and the guards who house them and documenting their lives. And the grand irony is that inside prison, it's nobody's job to punish. If you read the mission statements of the Departments of Corrections in the United States, including the federal mission statement, you will not find the word punishment or any of its synonyms in any department mission statement in the United States. And so when you ask the officers, what's your job? They respond almost with one voice. A, I don't care what a guy did out there. I only care how he behaves once he's inside. And B, my job is safety. I want to keep the public safe from him. I want to keep the inmates safe from each other. And I want to keep the staff safe from them. Consequently, they look at things, perks like televisions and good food and playtime, not just exercise, but playtime. They look at all of those kinds of things as management tools. And so if a person is well behaved, he moves to less and less restrictive life setting. He gets increasing privileges. And so the feeling that these guys will get what they deserve or that somehow life without parole is worse than the death penalty is based largely on an illusion and a hope, but it's false.
What about the loss of liberty?
Well, that's terrible, but that's no worse for him than it is for many nonviolent criminals who are serving life sentences right now for relatively trivial crimes. Look, if you're a retributivist advocate of the death penalty, which I am, essentially you want the punishment to fit the crime, which means you're just as committed to making sure that we adequately punish, in this case only by death, Tsarnaev, as that we don't overpunish. And we've got thousands of people inside prisons right now who will be serving meaningfully indistinguishable sentences with the same loss of liberty for crimes that are much more trivial, that they deserve much less. It's all part of a larger, this problem of life or death is part of a larger critique, which is that not only is the death penalty under attack, but punishment itself is under attack.
Robert Blecker again, the book, The Death of Punishment, The Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Robert Dunham is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, an opponent of capital punishment. Robert Dunham, good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What about the idea that the punishment should fit the crime? There's no question that this man, in fact, is guilty of the horrible crimes that have been demonstrated at great length.
Well, the punishment already fits the crime. The minimum punishment that can be meted out here is life without possibility of parole. The question is, will the punishment be greater than that? In the penalty phase of a capital trial, the jury is faced with the question of what is the appropriate punishment for this particular individual. It's unquestionable here that this is a very, very serious crime. It's unquestionable that it's a highly aggravated crime. But we all know from past experience with these cases that juries have to distinguish between the relative culpability of the perpetrators, and they've done that. For example, in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing, that is a case where if you were looking solely at the nature of the crime, you would suspect that anybody who is associated with it ought to be punished by death. Well, Timothy McVeigh was tried, and Timothy McVeigh was sentenced to death. But Terry Nichols, who was a lesser participant in the Oklahoma City bombing, was federally tried, federally sought the death penalty, got a life sentence. Oklahoma then sought the death penalty against him. He got a life sentence there. The jury was able to distinguish between degrees of participation. And that's not the only case. The Misawi case, the 9/11 participant who was not one of the bombers himself, Misawi gets tried federally, capital prosecution. He gets a life sentence. You have the case of the Washington area snipers, John Muhammad and Lee Malvo. Lee Malvo, a teenager, just as as Mr. Tsarnaev was here, under the dominion of an adult. Malva was isolated from his family. Malva was under the dominion of Mr. Muhammad. Muhammad gets death, Malva gets life. So there are very, very serious crimes, and they are very seriously punished, but juries do distinguish between the relative culpability of the perpetrators.
So, Robert Blecker, what do you say to that?
Well, the situations are not analogous. Of course, in this case, the ethos in the prison was don't snitch. But if somebody dies in the course of a robbery, then the dead man did everything, and that's what's going on here. The dead guy did everything. The relative culpability that he's talking about, of course, is the right thing to focus on. But in this case, it doesn't work as an analogy. The defense is going to be hammering away at the fact that he's a 19-year-old, and introducing evidence that 19-year-olds' brains are not fully formed, that our brains aren't fully formed till they're 25, and this is the same kind of argument that was done with Malvo, who was 17, by the way, not 19, and it turns out he was probably the leader of the two of them. But the point is, look, if a 19-year-old bravely runs into a burning building and risks his life to save children inside from an explosion, we celebrate, we reward his heroism. We don't, nor should we, dismiss his goodness and bravery as the product of a not yet fully formed personality. If we can fully celebrate the achievements and the heroism of the best of our young adults, why can't we fully condemn the cowardly viciousness of the worst? And that's the point. They're going to be playing on his youthfulness, relative youthfulness. At 19, you are fully formed in every moral way. There is no conclusive evidence that translates the biological, non-fully developed brain into a non-fully morally developed choice-making person.
Robert Dunham?
Well, that's simply not true. And the biological evidence is that the frontal lobes of the brain, which are the last part of the brain to develop, do not become fully formed until the mid to late 20s. And those are the parts of the brain that deal with impulse control. Those are the parts of the brain that deal with risk reward. Those are the parts of the brain that are at issue in this case. And frankly, the question of relative culpability, that's a factual question for the jury to decide. Nothing that I say and nothing that Professor Blecker says is going to affect how the jury looks at it, but they will look at it, and it is something for them to consider. And when juries were faced with Malvo versus Muhammad, his relatively younger age and the fact that he could be under the influence of Muhammad was a deciding factor. And when they were looking at Nichols versus McVeigh, the relative culpability and the lesser degree of participation by Nichols was a factor, and it resulted in a life verdict. We don't know how the jury is going to decide on this, but what we do know is that there are two very significant factors that juries have taken into consideration in very serious cases and have returned life verdicts for the less culpable person.
Andrea Lyon, let me go back to you. Dean, professor at Valparaiso School of Law, author of The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive, a friend of the defense attorney in this case, although you said you hadn't talked to her because you didn't want to have information that you couldn't repeat on programs like this. What about the sentence, if in fact it's a life in prison? What sort of conditions would you expect the defendant to be living under?
Well, I had to restrain myself when I was listening to Professor Rucker talk about how it's not punishment and there's TV. It's punishment. I mean, you are locked up. You're told what to do, where to go, when to get up, how to eat, and you're in a cell. So let's not kid ourselves that it is not punishment. That doesn't mean that people are being beaten. We don't do that, but they are being punished. And in all likelihood, Tsarnaev would end up in a max prison and possibly a super max prison. In super max prison, he would be isolated 22 to 23 hours out of every day, have very little in the way of human contact. They would keep him under very, very close wraps. So it will be a very serious punishment for him. And I think one of the things that perhaps might be of interest is that his lawyer, with his permission, basically did everything but plead guilty in this case. I am certain that had they offered him a plea for life without parole, he would have taken it, but there was no such offer. And so that is accepting responsibility and saying, I was a part of this, I might not have been the leader, but I was a part of this, and I'm responsible, is in fact mitigating evidence that the jury may think is another reason to choose the punishment of life rather than death. But again, I have to agree with my colleague from the Death Penalty Information Center that this the factual decision-making and the moral decision-making is the jury's to make. And what you or I might see from the outside, other than the terrible tragedy of this, of this act, is, we can speculate about it, but we aren't sitting in the chairs that those jurors are sitting in, trying to figure out what is the fair, the just, the moral, and ethical thing to do.
Robert Blecker, what will society lose, in your opinion, if, in fact, the verdict, or the sentence, rather, is life in prison rather than the death penalty?
They'll lose a sense of justice, and they'll also lose the opportunity to denounce him. Denunciation is one of the legitimate purposes of punishment. It provides a social adhesion and a social glue. And it actually has significance not only to us, it has significance to some of the guys who were condemned, who have described to me the sting that they felt when a jury actually stood up there and said, you deserve to die. So we will lose our sense of justice will be diminished somewhat.
What about what we just heard about the conditions that prisoners are in when they're sentenced to a life without parole? Isolation, 22, 24 hours a day, very little contact with other people. Often lawyers bring cases saying that they're being treated in a cruel and unusual way.
Yeah, well, he will, as was said, he will start out in a max and possibly a supermax, but that doesn't mean he will end up in a max or a supermax, because the whole ethos of the prison management is that how you behave when you're inside will affect the kinds of privileges to which you'll be accorded. Those people who tend to be the most vicious, who prey on vulnerable victims, also tend to be the most cowardly. So once they're confronted with overwhelming state power, they tend to be very compliant inside prison. So imagine Tsarnaev is completely well behaved, then he's likely to be given increasing privileges. And by the way, this notion about his virtually pleading guilty in the guilt phase, which shows his remorse or acts as a mitigator, that was a carefully constructed strategy on the part of the defense, which was to say to the jury, look, vent your spleen now here in the guilt phase, and that way find him guilty on all the counts, and that way you can start fresh in the penalty phase because you feel that you will have condemned him by finding him guilty. That's a strategy and a tactic that has nothing to do with taking responsibility.
Andrea Lyon, what about this idea of a sense of justice when the punishment, according to Professor Blecker, doesn't fit the crime, and the idea that we need to denounce and make feel denounced people who commit crimes of this kind?
The guilty verdict is the denunciation. So he has been denounced. He has been found guilty, and he is going to be apart from the rest of us for the rest of his life, no matter what the jury chooses. You can't tell someone not to feel what they feel. And, if the professor feels in his heart that the only thing that will make up for something like this is the death of another, I can't tell him not to feel that. But one of the things he needs to remember, or that you need to remember, is there is no one on this jury, not one person on this jury, who doesn't believe that death is appropriate sometimes. If they didn't believe that, they would not be allowed to sit. So that means that the only people on this jury making the decision, the only people on the Terry Nichols jury or other juries that have chosen life over death, have been chosen by people who do think death might be appropriate some of the time. So if this jury decides that life is appropriate, then I think that the jury should be respected for that. And all this talk about how there's no real punishment in prison is frankly just nonsense.
Robert Dunham, is the fact that the jurors all had to say that they were able to impose a death sentence if that was necessary, does that make them unrepresentative of the people of Boston who, when polled, have indicated that they don't support the death penalty?
Yes, it does make them unrepresentative of the people of Boston. And there are legal issues and constitutional issues that are implicated here. First of all, with the
quickly, if you will, because we're almost out of time.
Most of the community in Boston has said that they oppose the death penalty and oppose it in this case. If you exclude from the jury all the folks who say they cannot cast the first stone, then a jury comprised solely of people who can is not capable of reflecting the conscience of the Boston community.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Once again, many questions have arisen here and will be worked out in the days to come. We will see what happens. Robert Dunham, Robert Blecker, Andrea Lyon, thank you all very much for being on our program. In 1975, Peter Singer made a global impact with his book Animal Liberation. He's now focused on charity and how everyone has the obligation not just to give away whatever they can afford, but to get the biggest bang for their buck. We'll talk with him in a moment on To The Point.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. Peter Singer's latest book is The Most Good You Can Do, How Effective Altruism is Changing Ideas About Living Ethically. It argues that everybody should give away a substantial amount of income to charities, but there's a word of caution. Not all philanthropy is good philanthropy. Peter Singer, welcome to The Point.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Peter Singer, many of our listeners give to NPR stations like this one or art museums or other traditional charities. Is that wrong?
Let's draw some distinctions. Art museums, I think yes. I think in the world in which we live, where there are a billion people in extreme poverty, where there are children dying because they can't get basic things like anti-malaria nets to stop them getting malaria, or they haven't been immunized against measles, where people are blind because they have cataracts, which could very simply be removed, I think art museums are not a priority. Now, and I'm not saying this just because I know you're an NPR station, but I do actually think that non-commercial radio and non-commercial television is important to get a different kind of message across to the American public. And in the absence of anything like the BBC in Britain or the Australian equivalent, I think it is essential for the public to support independent public radio and public television.
So effective altruism and living ethically then, as you define them, essentially means making choices.
Oh, absolutely it means making choices. And of course, you know, we want to leave people with these choices, but we want to inform them better. One of the funny things about philanthropy and charity is that people don't seem concerned about getting value for their money. And this is in complete contrast with buying consumer items. For example, if you wanted to buy a new dishwasher and you read reviews that said, this dishwasher is twice as expensive as the other one, and it doesn't wash the dishes as well either, you're not likely to buy it, are you? But when people donate to charities, they don't even ask that question. They don't really ask, does this charity give me as much for my dollar as some other charity? Or does it give me perhaps not just, you know, half as much, but in some cases we would say some charities are tens of times or hundreds of times more effective than others.
Let's go back to art and to music as well. If, as you say, there is so much misery in the world, what about the idea of alleviating it by spreading the kind of joy and enrichment that art and music provide?
The question isn't whether art and music provide joy and enrichment. They certainly do. And, you know, people will express themselves artistically and make music almost in whatever circumstances they are, including if they're poor. But the question really is whether by donating to a museum or a concert hall or something like that, you're really so dramatically increasing the amount of joy that the music or the art provides that it's more important than restoring sight in people who are blind because of a curable condition or saving the life of a child. And I just can't see that it is. I can't see that, for example, when the Metropolitan Museum in New York buys a new painting for $45 million. I can't see that that makes such a huge difference to the experience of people visiting the Met who, you know, already have so many wonderful paintings to look at that I don't think one can make a huge difference.
Let's break it down. Suppose you have $60,000 in yearly income. How much of it should go to charity? How much do you keep for yourself?
That will depend on what your other commitments are. So knowing someone's income is not enough. What I suggest in the book and what you can people can find on the website, thelifeyoucansave.org, is a sliding scale of giving, which starts quite low. And for somebody on $60,000, it might just start at 1%, which, you know, is only $600 a year that I think somebody like that can probably spare. But the idea is to get in the habit of giving something, and then if your income increases, to actually increase the percentage. So you're not just giving more because it's the same percentage, but a higher percentage. And some people will actually find that on $60,000, they're quite comfortable with giving more. Maybe they'll even give 10%. It will depend on their commitments and what their requirements are.
Okay, you go for $60,000. I understand what you're saying. You profile in your book Matt Wage, a Princeton philosophy student who went to work on Wall Street as a trader, making a lot more than $60,000. Why is he a model for you?
Yes, it's an interesting choice. Most people wouldn't realize that you could do a lot of good by going to Wall Street, not because Wall Street traders are themselves in their work doing a lot of good. Maybe some of them are, but some of them aren't. But because by earning more, you can give more. And that was Matt's plan. I mean, he could have been a philosophy professor. He was a brilliant philosophy student, was accepted by excellent graduate schools to go to. But after thinking about whether the world really needed another professor of philosophy, he decided that the difference he would make by going into philosophy would be marginal. Whereas by going to Wall Street, he was within a year of graduation able to donate a six-figure sum to effective charities. Now, obviously, for that, he has to earn more than six figures, and he has to not adopt the lavish lifestyle of some people on Wall Street who do earn more than six figures, but rather has to see his high earnings as an opportunity to do more good in the world. And that's what makes him an effective altruist.
Is he making a sacrifice by doing that kind of work? Maybe he has contempt for it. Maybe he finds it essentially not up to his ethical standards just to try to make money for other people.
No, he doesn't. I've had him back to talk to my class, the same class that he took about three or four years ago. And he actually finds the work intellectually interesting, challenging. And he doesn't think that the firm that he's working for is really doing harm. It's an arbitrage trader that basically what it's doing is, I guess, smoothing jumps in price by trying to get in early and taking positions in things where it predicts that prices will either rise or fall. So he sees it as effectively, I guess, harmless, not particularly doing great good, but anyway, at worst, harmless. And as I say, it gives him an opportunity to make a big impact with highly effective charities.
He's relatively young. Is the millennial generation, as it's called, more likely to listen to the kind of guidance that you're providing than older people?
There's no doubt that effective altruism as a social movement, an emerging social movement, is particularly strong among the millennials. Most of the people that I talk to are of that generation. And it's an interesting question as to why. It might be that they are less worried about economic security than earlier generations, and they're more interested in finding meaning in their lives. They're more interested in using their lives to do something positive. It might be that they've grown up with the internet and social media, and they therefore chat to people with similar ideas and find them quite easily, whereas if you go back to a pre-internet era, and you'd had these ideas, depending where you lived, of course, you might have thought, oh, I seem to be the only person who thinks like this, who thinks that I should use my life to do the most good. And then you get isolated and you feel, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, maybe there's something weird about me and I should just do what everybody else does. But once you have an internet community exchanging ideas, saying, yes, I think the same, let's talk about the best way to do it, then you have a different situation and the movement can grow and spread.
Let's go back to the question of putting value on one thing as opposed to another and making choices. You talk a lot about the developing world. You did already on our program in helping children who are suffering and people who are going blind because of various diseases that we don't have. What about the homeless, mentally ill that are wandering the streets of American cities? Are they less important than the people in other countries?
They're certainly not less important, and I do have sympathy for their situation. The question, though, is how can we help them, and how much expense and resources does it take to help them? I mean, you mentioned that some of them are there because they're mentally ill. Well, mental illness is difficult to treat. I would certainly like to see the U.S. governments providing better support for the mentally ill. I think that could be a very effective and important thing to do. But if it comes to my individual decisions about philanthropy, and I know that to treat somebody who's mentally ill may cost, let's say, $20,000 per year and is not at all guaranteed to be successful. And on the other hand, I know that for much less than that, maybe a tenth of that or perhaps even less, I can help somebody's to save somebody's life, to save the life of a child maybe, or for less than that still, I can restore someone's sight. Estimates for the cost of that run to something like $50 to $100. So I, you know, for $20,000, I could save 200 people's, restore sight to 200 people or prevent 200 people going blind. That does seem to me to be a better thing to do. You know, even weighing the importance of those who are homeless on the streets just as much as others, I think the numbers of people that you can help for that amount of money does make a difference.
Peter Singer, thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Professor Singer teaches philosophy at Princeton and the University of Melbourne. He's author of The Most Good You Can Do, How Effective Altruism is Changing Ideas About Living Ethically. I'm Warren Olney. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.